welcome all of you to East Lake Church. Thank you for being here. As you heard, we are in this series called First Person, where we're looking at these things called the Synoptic Gospels. And these Gospels are the books of Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And if you've been following along, we've gone through Mark already, and we're actually in the final week of talking about Matthew, and we're going to look at Luke starting next week. And we're going to look at a story today that's really kind of interesting because it takes on this issue that's really big to Jesus. And that's where we separate sort of what we say we are and what we really do. And I had an experience just a couple years ago that I'm willing to share with all of you that it's kind of embarrassing. And it was one of these moments where I kind of bumped into like the difference between at least who I really am and maybe who I'm perceived to be. My wife and I went to the mall, and as sometimes happens when you go to the mall, parking was terrible. So I said, you know what, hey, let's just pull up to the store, and you can hop out and go in the store, and then I'll park. So we do that, and she hops out of the car, and I'm looking down, you know, doing something responsible, like looking at my phone. So I'm looking down, and I see that she's no longer at the side of the car. She's actually in front of the car. And we have this dumb thing we do, and when I say we, I really mean I have this dumb thing I do, which is if my wife or my kids are near the car and they're not looking, I honk the horn because I think it's hilarious to watch them jump. And I'm a bad person, and I know that, but it's funny. It's hilarious to me. And so I see out of the corner of my eye, she's actually moved to the front of the car. And if I look up, I mean, she's going to catch that I'm looking, and, you know, the game's going to be over. So I think, like, okay, don't look, just, and I laid on the horn. It was amazing. She jumped so high. I mean, like Draymond Green, like NBA dunk level. It was beyond that. Like, no kidding, at the top of the jump, I think she could see the curvature of the earth. That's how high up she was. And so she comes down, and I'm just like, I'm laughing. This is so funny. And, like, I look over, and she's at the side of the car shaking her head at me. And I go, how did she land on the side of the car? Oh, no, that wasn't my wife. And I look, and this poor woman is scurrying away from the car into the mall, and my wife is shaking her head. And fellas, if you're married, you know the shake I'm talking about. It says so much. She's just, and it's everything. It's, I told you not to do this. I really could have married somebody smarter. I mean, all of that is wrapped in there, right, all at once. And so she walks into the store, and she's still shaking her head the whole way. And I'm thinking, I got to go park the car. And I think what I'm going to do, I think I'm just going to stay in the car, right? I'm not going to go in. And I sit in the car for a little while. And I'm like, I can't stay here the whole time. So I go in the store, and I find my wife, and she's still shaking her head at me, understandably. And so, I go, and I'm like, I can't believe I did that. I'm so embarrassed. Can you believe I did? And she's like, of course I can believe that. This is the sort of thing you would do. And so I'm just dying. And you know what's about to happen. To my left, 8-10 feet away, there she is, right? The lady that I honked at. And it's kind of like that moment in the scary movie where they're like, the killer is inside the house. And I'm like, she's inside the store. Oh, no. So what am I going to do, right? It's awkward. I got to go apologize. I have to go apologize. So I walk over, and I'm pretty sure this is what I said. I said, I'm really sorry to bother you again. I'm the idiot who just honked his horn at you because I thought you were my wife, but I didn't really see very well, and it's this dumb joke that I have. And so I honked the horn, and I thought it was her, and then it was you, and I'm really sorry I ruined your day, and I'm kind of an idiot, I'm sorry. And she turns and looks at me, and there's this flicker of recognition. And she goes, East Lake Church, right? Oh, the worst. Right? The worst possible. And I'm like, no. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I'm one of the pastors. God bless you. And like, it's this terrible moment, right, where what you think you're going to be perceived as and what you really are two wildly different things, right? And that's not really the thing that scares us in life. What scares us in life isn't bumping into perceptions, because the truth of the matter is, if you walk around one day with me, I'm going to disappoint you. I'm going to do stuff that you know, will let you down. I know that. But what's really a problem is when we separate not the perception of who we are, but who we say we are, the values that we have, and our actions. That's when it's really a problem. And Jesus speaks really critically of that. That's something we know in our culture and we hate it. It's hypocrisy. It's the politician who runs for office on a platform of, I'm going to stop corruption. And they get elected and they're taking bribes. It's the religious leader who crusades against immorality, and then you find out he's having an affair. It's that person at the office who's like, you know, I can't stand people who are liars, and you find out they're not speaking a word of truth ever. And man, I'll tell you what, if I need to look for a hypocrite, I usually don't have to look too far beyond my own mirror, because I know that there are times that there's a separation between what I say I believe and what I really do. And in Matthew chapter 23, which is not what we're going to look at today, but it's two chapters before, Jesus calls out all these religious leaders. He calls them out for being hypocrites. He tells them, you know what? What you say you believe and what you actually do, they're very far apart. He says, your words and your actions don't line up. And he tells the people, you know what? Do what the leaders say, but not what they do. It's a huge criticism. But then you skip ahead to Matthew chapter 25, which is where we're at today. And you see that what Jesus does is he describes this thing that's going to happen to this separation of people. That honestly, we all have good intentions. We all want to take care of people. We all want to do good things. But some of us follow through on it, and some of us fall short. And he talks about this separation that's going to happen. Take a look with me at the scripture. It says, but when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit upon his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered in his presence, and he will separate the people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will place the sheep at his right hand and the goats at his left. There are six passages in the New Testament that vividly describe this, what we describe as the day of judgment. And what's interesting is they all include this notion of Jesus sitting on a throne. And I mention that because we've talked earlier in the series about this notion of a kingdom, that Jesus rules this kingdom. Well, why do we talk about this throne? Because he's now ruling over the kingdom. The kingdom that we've talked about in earlier weeks, it's come to pass. He's here, he's returned, and the kingdom is now. But he's doing something really interesting. He's separating now the sheep and the goats. Sheep to his right, goats to his left. Now, I'm left-handed, so I've never really liked that particular passage because the goats, who are bad, go off to the left. But for us, this sheep and goats thing, it's honestly, it's kind of confusing because we don't really live in this rural pastoral culture. I mean, for us, honestly, it would make more sense if Jesus was like, all right, I'm going to come back and separate you. Okay, iPhone 6S's on the right and like Motorola flip phones on the left. And we would all go, oh, well, I know, I don't want to be one of those, right? That would make more sense to us. But to people of that time, they all understood what sheep and goats were all about, right? People would understand that sheep are friendly and good. Take a look at this guy. This is a sheep. Look at that. Who doesn't want to be that, right? He looks friendly. Goats, on the other hand, are just, well, who wants to be, right? Nobody wants to be that guy. And I've actually had to corral goats in my life. You might not believe that, but my brother, he got married in Kenya, and he had to pay a dowry. Like, they still do this in parts of the world. He had to pay a dowry of livestock to my now sister-in-law's family, and he and I had to herd the livestock, and that included some goats. And let me tell you, goats are cantankerous, disagreeable, loud, they don't listen. So it's not what you want to be. And everyone in Jesus' day would have known, oh yeah, I don't want to be one of the goats, I want to be one of the sheep. And so people are sort of wondering, okay, so what do you have to do to make the cut? How do you have to make it onto the sheep list and not the goat list? Well, that's what comes next in the scripture. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger and you invited me into your home. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you cared for me. I was in prison and you visited me. Jesus is saying this basic idea, the sheep, the good ones, The ones on his right side are the ones who did all of these things to care for people. And this is where this issue of hypocrisy comes in. And you might think, well, he's not really talking about hypocrites. But the truth is, we all want to care for people. We all want to do good things. We all want to see good in the world. Those are our intentions. But sometimes our actions don't line up. And what we say we believe and what we really do, they get separated. Now, I have the good fortune right now of speaking to a church that really values all of these things that Jesus is talking about. And basically, it's kind of a room full of sheep, and I mean that in a good way, because we're a church that partners with the San Diego Rescue Mission because they're caring for the homeless. We partner with the BSCC, the Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition, because they are rescuing girls from sexual slavery in our city. This is still happening. And there are people out there that are making it stop. And we partner with them. We partner with Charity Water because they're providing that drink of clean water to people who have never had access to it before. We partner with the Bright Hope School in Uganda, where kids, orphans, and children in need, they get education and care, and people watch out for them. Those are wonderful things that our church does. But the truth of the matter is, Jesus didn't say, well, to get on this list, make sure you just go to a church that does good stuff. Then you're off the hook. And that's not what he says. He says, you've got to do it. Individually, we've got responsibilities. He's kind of calling us all out for what we individually do. And here's the other good news. We have churches full of people that take that really, really seriously. We could spend the rest of our time together just telling stories of that, but just a couple that come to my mind. There was a young single woman in our church, and she was expecting her first child, and she didn't have any of the stuff you need when you're expecting a baby. She didn't have a car seat. She didn't have diapers. She didn't have clothes. She didn't have any of it. And some women at our church found out about it, and they threw her a baby shower. That's awesome. They just threw a party. Did they know her? No. But they threw a party for her. Why? Because that's what people who love other people do. We have you might have seen a video that we showed about this maybe a year or two ago. There's a young man in our church who very suddenly lost his hearing. And we have a woman in our church who, for her work, she does closed captioning for news. And so she just does closed captioning for him in our services. Why? Because that's what loving people do. They care for other people. We have small groups right now that are gathering backpacks of school supplies for kids that are going back to school soon, and they'll need those things. Some friends of mine, they get together with other couples, and they go downtown, and they feed the homeless, and they give clothes and all of that. And that's a great thing. We should celebrate that, because honestly, that's what sheep, the good guys, do. But there's a hard realization that comes along with that, and we have to face that, and it's that sometimes these things can really wear us down, right? And it's because of this, we haven't permanently solved any of these problems yet. These problems still exist. And sometimes that exhaustion, when you work so hard and your intentions are good, but you just get worn down, that's where our intentions and our actions start to separate. No matter what we do, we feel like what we bring to the table, it's not a drop in a bucket, it's a drop in the ocean. It's this endless sea of need that we just can't ever seem to fill. We sponsor the children at the orphanage in Uganda, but one graduates and there's another one who needs the help. And when we work with the BSCC and they're able to rescue a girl off of the streets in San Diego, they put her in the safe house and give her the resources she needs, and she can redo her life, and it's great, and she goes on, and you know what? There's another girl right there behind her who needs help. You can go downtown and feed the homeless, and that's awesome, and that's great, and you know what? Tomorrow's going to come, and it's going to be a new day, and they're going to be hungry again. And we get to a point where, I don't know about you, but honestly, it kind of grinds me down sometimes, where I just go, I feel like I'm walking through an emergency room and everybody's bleeding profusely and I've got like this little box of Band-Aids. Maybe I can help a little, but I don't know that I can really solve the problem permanently, make the kind of difference I'd like to. And if I'm honest, I get so overwhelmed that my intentions, my actions, again, they start to separate. And I start to ask these questions where I'm really not just questioning, I'm denying my responsibility, where I start to go, well, you know, I'm sorry these people have needs, but I didn't create the problem. You know, I didn't make these people poor. I didn't cast them out on the street. And maybe they made bad decisions. Maybe that's why they're out there. And you know what? I got problems of my own. I'll admit that there are times that I can feel that coming up inside of me. And we all think of these reasons sometimes to just back away. And I know. This is the moment where a lot of people expect me to bring the hammer, right? To go, you know what? You're a bad person if you feel that way. If you feel that way, you're wrong and you're bad and you shouldn't do that. What you should really do is go sell all your stuff, give it to the poor, and pretend you're happy about it. And that's not what I'm saying. Here's the truth. We're all vulnerable to compassion fatigue. We're all vulnerable to it. We're all susceptible to just feeling worn down. We have the potential to get overwhelmed and to want to give up. And maybe that's never happened to you, but if it hasn't, you're the lucky exception. Because for most of us, we get that point, we hit the wall, and we just want to give up. And our good intentions and our actions separate. In 1993, there was a famine in the country of Sudan. If you don't know where Sudan is, it's in northern Africa. It's actually just below the southern border of Egypt. And the famine was bad, but it might have been manageable. They might have been able to get through it okay, but unfortunately, at the same time, there's a civil war in the country. So being able to get food to people and all of that was incredibly difficult. And so people were starving. They were starving to death. And a young photojournalist named Kevin Carter was assigned to Sudan, and he went there to cover what was happening. And he landed at a feeding center where they were bringing food to people so that they wouldn't starve. And when he got to the feeding center, he heard just outside this whimpering sound. And he turned, and he saw a little girl on the ground. And he took this photo. And this photo is chilling to look at. It's one of those things you see that you kind of want to unsee. Because it's not just the desperation of this young girl. There's a vulture 20 feet away. That's how bad it was. And Kevin Carter, the photographer, he was prohibited from doing anything to touch the children because he was an outsider and their immune systems were so ravaged that he could actually make things worse. So he took the photo and, to his great credit, he chased the vulture away. But ultimately, He had to leave, and they ushered him out, and he never was able to find out what happened to that little girl. Well, as it turned out, that photo went on the cover of the New York Times, and then it was picked up by newspapers all over the world and became the photo of the Sudanese famine, and it won him the Pulitzer Prize in photojournalism. So he then went to the top of his field, the top of his career, and you think about this dichotomy of he's at the top of his field, it's his greatest work, and the desperation and hurt of this little girl. How do you reconcile those two things? Well, tragically, Carter couldn't reconcile it. And just over 3 months after winning the Pulitzer Prize, he actually took his own life. And he left a note, and he said this on the note, "I'm haunted by the vivid memories of killings and corpses and anger and pain, of starving and wounded children, of trigger-happy madmen, of killer executioners." You know, Carter had gotten past a point of fatigue, past a point of exhaustion. He'd reached a point of hopelessness, and that's what we have to avoid. We get so overwhelmed by how awful it is that we just withdraw and we just give up. Jesus actually says in Matthew and Mark that we'll always have the poor with us, but he didn't mean, well, they'll always be there, shrug, what are you going to do? That's not what Jesus was saying. What Jesus was saying is there's always going to be an opportunity until I return to care for people. The Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard really just cut to the chase when he said this, talking about what our response should be, even when we feel overwhelmed. The matter is quite simple. The Bible is very easy to understand. We pretend to be unable to understand it because we know very well that the minute we understand, we're obliged to act accordingly. See, the passage we read in Matthew 25 makes it very clear. Jesus is saying this: help people with the basic needs of life, food, clothing, shelter, acceptance, love. Those things count too. It's not hard to understand, but sometimes, again, our intentions, we want to do that, but we get so overwhelmed. It seems like so much, we can never fix it all, that we just fall away. And that's where we start to feel that hypocrisy of, I want to solve it, but my actions don't back that up. And I know that I've lived in that place. We can all read the Bible and see this basic truth. Following Jesus without serving others is a contradiction. Now, that's one of the many reasons that we offer lots of places to serve at our churches. Because you're going to learn a lot more about Jesus from serving people than you are just by sitting and reading a book. Reading a book is really important and good. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but you've got to also serve. That's actually Jesus' plan. And he spells that out very clearly in the next few verses. Then these righteous ones will reply, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you something to drink? Or a stranger and show you hospitality? Or naked and give you clothing? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will say, I tell you the truth, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me. Jesus is basically saying, look, if you want to find me, I'm with the orphans and widows. I'm with the hungry and the homeless. I'm with the destitute and the lonely. I'm right there. He's right in the middle of the pain and the suffering that so many people experience. And I know for me, I sometimes feel like, how do I find the energy to not just give up? When you see so much pain, when you see a photo like that and you go, gosh, how can this happen in a world I live in? Well, let me ask you this, if you're a Jesus follower, are you grateful for what Jesus has done for you? Are you grateful for his forgiveness? Are you a different person because of what he's done in your life? And if the answer is yes to any of those, if the answer is yes to all of those, here's what you do. You just express your gratitude. You just say, Jesus, you've done so much for me. I just want to say thanks. And how do you say thanks? You say thanks by taking care of the basic needs of the people around you. That's how Jesus wants us to express our love to him, is by expressing love to the people who need help. That's what cures compassion fatigue. See, if you just serve people and you help people because you think, like, you're the superhero who can fly in with the red cape and the big S on your chest, and you're going to make everything good through your own strength, you know what? Eventually, your strength will give out. But if you can rely on this gratitude, this relationship with Jesus, you can pull from a well that's always refreshing because it never runs dry. There's always reasons to be thankful for what Jesus has done. Now, does that mean you're not going to get discouraged? Oh, no. You're going to get discouraged. That's never going to go away. But it means you're not going to get overwhelmed. If you're pulling from your gratitude and your thankfulness, you're going to have that strength to keep your actions and your intentions lined up. And it's for a very straightforward reason, which is this: when you serve others, you become the hands of Jesus. Believe it or not, that's Jesus' plan. Now, he could have come up with any number of other ways to do this, to care for the world, but he chose to use you and me. That's the plan. If I were involved in the recommendation, honestly, that's probably not the recommendation I would have given. I would have been like, Jesus, okay, here's the thing. You're relying on me. I've met me, and I'm kind of impatient, and I kind of get frustrated easy, and I'm not always the nicest person, and I sometimes can give up when I get frustrated, and maybe there's another plan that you have that doesn't involve me. And some of you are saying, you know what, Kevin, I actually know you, and you're really just scratching the surface of the flaws that you have, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Keep it quiet. But the point is that Jesus uses us not because we're great, but because he's great. He uses us in spite of the fact that we're not great. He's so great, he can even use me. And he can use you too. Mother Teresa, who served in Calcutta, she devoted her entire life to this great concept. She called it this wholehearted free service to the poorest of the poor. And she used these phrases that I'm going to share with you in a moment, that it's the most brilliant way of describing Christian service that I've ever heard. She had an interview with Time magazine, and she said this: I don't claim anything of the work. It's his work. I'm like a little pencil in his hand. That's all. He does the thinking, he does the writing. The pencil has nothing to do with it. The pencil has only to be allowed to be used. Now, that's a pretty solid description of what it's like to be used by Jesus, because he's writing the story, but he's willing to let us be the pencil in his hand while he does it. And that leads us to this crucial truth. Faith is more than a belief in something. Faith is a response to someone. See, we get this notion that faith is about agreeing with some sort of checklist of ideas, and that's a part of it, but it's a lot bigger than that. Faith is this day-in, day-out response to Jesus, to who he is. And I feel like it's really unfortunate that so many people in our world, they see the church as this club of people. They get together to decide all the things that they're mad about. And that's what defines the church to so many people in the world. And that's not what the church is supposed to be. The church is supposed to be the hands of Jesus, responding to the needs by loving people. In this whole world full of people in need, we're just supposed to go out there and love them. Why? Because that's what Jesus said to do, because that's what he wants. Can you imagine what it would be like if the way the church was viewed by people outside of it was that we were all about just caring for people, loving people. The people say, man, you know, I don't know much about those Christians, but they sure do seem to care for people a lot. Man, they sure do seem to love people a lot. Like, how awesome would that be? That would be an incredible thing. And if anyone should be prepared, it's us as Christians. Look at the words of Luke in the book of Acts. He says, there were no needy people among them. He's describing the church. They were unselfish. They cared for each other. Did they have disagreements and conflict? Yes, they were people. It's inevitable. But they still found a way to get past that. And what defined them was care. What defined them was love and generosity. If anyone should be prepared, it's us as Christians, because we've been provided so much love by Jesus. In 1 John, it says this, we know what real love is because Jesus gave up his life for us. So we also ought to give up our lives for our brothers and our sisters. See, Jesus gave up his life for you and for me, and don't miss this. It's not because you and I are so good. It's not because we earned it. In fact, it's the opposite. He did it despite the fact that we didn't earn it, despite the fact that we kind of screw it up from time to time and we don't always get it right. See, in that book, John is saying, because of that, because Jesus gives us this love that we didn't earn, we should go ahead and love people who haven't earned it. So here's the challenge for you and for me this week. Who's Jesus putting in your path? Who's he putting right in front of you that you can love, that you can care for? Just this week. You don't have to solve all the world's problems. Who's Jesus going to put in front of you this week that you can care for? Is it somebody that has a real financial need that you can help them with? Is it that single mom and she needs a car seat, or she needs somebody to watch her kids? Is it an organization here that you can partner with and use your gifts to make a difference for people in a world of hurt? Is it a stranger on the street who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from? And you actually might be able to be an answer to that very problem. Is it just someone who feels rejected and lonely and lost and needs someone to come and say, you matter. You matter to me. You matter to God. You are worthwhile. That's the way that we can be the hands of Jesus in the world today. If you open yourself up, I'm going to give you a little dare. If you open yourself up for this week, you go, hey, all right, Jesus, I'm open for business. Whoever, you know, if you're really there, okay, put somebody in my path that I can care for. I guarantee you it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And like, it's going to happen. It'll be like Tuesday afternoon or whatever. And you'll be like, that's what the guy at church said was going to happen, right? And you're going to go, oh man, I can actually do something to help this person. That's what we're to do. That's what we're to do. We can't solve all the world's problems, but we can take care of the person who's right in front of us. I want to leave you with one final thought, and that's this. Jesus is returning. When I was a kid, I remember people would talk about Jesus coming back, and it used to scare me. Yeah, it would terrify me. And it was kind of like, I don't know if this will make sense, but it was kind of like we had the substitute teacher in class, like for a couple of days, and we were really bad. and then the real teacher was coming back, and you knew, oh man, we are going to get yelled at, we're going to get extra homework, we're going to get detention, like this is not going to go well for us. And Jesus is the regular teacher coming back. That's the way I felt about it. It's that notion like mom used to say, just wait till your father gets home. It's kind of like, just wait till Jesus comes back. Like, well, I don't know if I want that. It sounds kind of scary. And that's not the spirit that it's said in. That's not the spirit that we want to have with it. Because when Jesus comes back, all of these problems, all of these wrongs, all of these hurts that we see in the world around us, he's going to remedy all of that. He's going to fix all of that. And then we won't have to worry about the separation between our intentions and our actions. When my oldest son was a toddler, he's 19 now and he towers over me, but when he was a toddler, he had a really neat experience, which was when my brother John came out to visit. And my brother John is awesome with little kids. Like he's energy and fun and chases them around and does all that stuff that honestly as a parent you're too tired to do. And so like my son just loved having Uncle John there. One of the things about my brother is that he's always been a runner. So every day he'd go out and he'd go for a run. And Sam, my son, would sit on the front porch and he'd watch my brother run off and he'd just wait for him to come back. And then my brother would come back. And it was awesome. And I remember about a week after my brother had left and gone back home to the East Coast, Sam was sitting on the front porch. He was just kind of sitting there waiting, looking down the street. And he was pointing, and he went, Awaja, Awaja. He said, Uncle John. He was waiting for my brother to come back because that's the spirit we want to have. He wanted my brother to come back because he had so much fun with him. Now, the truth of the matter is he was pointing at a fire hydrant, and his eyes weren't very good, so that's why he wears corrective lenses now. But stay with me. The point is that's the spirit that we want to wait with Jesus. We want to wait for him to come expectantly, like, oh, man, he's coming back. And when he comes back, it's going to be great. And he's going to fix all the stuff that's wrong. That's who we want to be. But what's going to happen after that? That's the question. After he does this thing and he separates the sheep and the goats, and we want to be on that sheep list, then what happens? Well, the answer is we really don't know all the details of what happens then. But C.S. Lewis, he wrote, you're probably familiar with, The Chronicles of Narnia. And that's this whole story that talks about, in this metaphorical way, Jesus interacting with humanity. In the very last passage of the very last book in The Chronicles of Narnia, it talks about how Aslan has come back. And Aslan represents Jesus. And Aslan has come back for the children, and they're all with him, and it's his return. C.S. Lewis is really writing about the return of Christ, and he wrote this. The things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all stories, and we can most truly say that they lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world had only been the cover and the title page. And now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the greatest story which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever and ever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. There is pain and there is sorrow in this world. And Jesus he's asking for you and me to step up and care for people. And one day he's going to come back and he's going to right those wrongs. And he's going to make sure that everyone has what they need. And he's going to dry every tear. And when that happens, here's the thing. It's not the end of the story. It's the beginning. See, God is authoring this story that never ends. And with every page it gets better. And just like Mother Teresa said, all he needs from you and for me, it's to be that little pencil in his hand as he writes the story. Would you pray with me? Jesus, I thank you that you've invited us to be a part of what you're doing. And I ask that you would give us wisdom and give us strength that comes from you so that we don't get discouraged and overwhelmed when we see the needs of the world around us. Lord, I pray that you would give us the wisdom to know how we can step in and do your will and be your hands in this world around us. I ask that you would help us to know where we can step in and to continue to fill our sails with fresh wind that could only come from you. And it's in your name that we pray all of these things. Amen.